After I got pregnant, I couldn't wait to find out that I was right about my prediction. During an early ultrasound, I pestered the doctor, who said he couldn't really tell if it was a girl. Oh my God, either he has the smallest penis ever, or she has the biggest vagina. Either way, this is not good. If my kid has a little dick, I gotta tell him how to use it. And if it's a girl with a very big vagina, we gotta talk about that too. I wanted to be prepared. We need to know, Doc. We need to know. He ordered an amnio, which was encouraged, as I was close to 35, which confirmed it. We were having a girl. Angelo was in trouble. I gave the experience of being pregnant everything I had, particularly the eating part. At my four-month doctor's visit, the OB suggested I talk to a nutritionist. Why, Doc? Because you've already gained all your weight for the whole pregnancy, and then some. I was floored. I knew things were bad, but I didn't know they were this bad. I'm not asking for Big Macs. It's this kid. I can't control what she wants me to have. You're going to have a hard time if you keep up like this, he said. You're telling me I gained all this weight? You're telling me all this weight is just me? She has a head, right? How many pounds does a human baby's head weigh? That's got to be something. Did you take that into consideration? The entire fetus is probably around 5 ounces. Really? Jesus, a liver doesn't mean anything, I guess. All told, I gained, wait for it, 80 pounds over the course of my pregnancy. And it was no mystery why. I went 3 Egg McMuffins and 4 hash browns crazy. I kept Stephanie, the poor craft services person on the King of Queens, busy making me food. We just feel like mac and cheese, I said to her, the baby needs it. When Stephanie returned with a bowl of mac and cheese, I told her I would need more than just the sample portion. That was the whole box, she said. From Kraft? Yeah, Kraft macaroni and cheese. This is the whole box? I just want to make sure, I said. The whole box, she said. Did the FDA start regulating portion sizes? I don't understand. She smiled in sympathy and walked out of my room. While a lot of actresses in Hollywood can hide their pregnancy on screen with a strategically placed pillow or a bigger purse, on The King of Queens, I had to use a couch. I was so huge that I literally had to stand behind furniture to hide my belly. Kevin relished the fact that I was so fat. This is so great, he said. I look like the skinnier one here for the first time. At first, I was really into the whole pregnancy thing. I rented a heart monitor and I would sit there for hours listening to her heartbeat. Or I went into her little room. I loved going in there because it already smelled like a baby. I sat in the rocking chair or folded and refolded her baby clothes about 1,000 times. I would imagine her in my arms. By the 8th month, however, I was over it. At my OB appointment, I told the doctor, I think she needs to come out. He replied that my request was not only crazy, but also illegal. My feet are so swollen, I can't even wear flip-flops, man, seriously. I made noises during this time that I didn't even realize were coming from me. I would wake up in a panic, looking for the wild boar that had entered my room, only to realize it was me. The doctor had been right about gaining so much weight, making things hard. Getting up from the couch left me out of breath. One guy asked me if I was having twins. Don't ask anybody that ever. I started telling people who asked when I was due, I already had my baby, just to be a bitch. Yeah, I had her 9 months ago. When I went into labor and headed to the hospital, they put me in a room with a view of Jerry's Deli. All I could think about was why I hadn't gotten my tuna fish on a Kaiser with fries before I went into the hospital. I was miserable. My plan was to be a good Scientologist and not use an epidural, but when I felt the real thing go down, I yelled, "Get the anesthesiologist in here before I kill somebody!" The doctor was on it and told me he didn't know why I had waited so long. I didn't even try to explain to him that the church teaches you that drugs will make the baby susceptible to what is said during labor so that it gets recorded in your child's reactive mind, the place where pain is stored. So if I said to a nurse, "You're a horrible person," my daughter might go through life acting out the role of a horrible person, thinking I was talking to her. Similarly, that's the reason Scientologists espouse the concept of silent birth, which LRH described in Dianetics as providing an environment where no one, not even the doctors or nurses in the room, talks during the delivery. Again, it's because in times of pain, loss, or unconsciousness, words in particular spoken during these moments can have an adverse effect on one later in life. Women can make sounds during birth, they just aren't supposed to say any words. Once the doctor gave me the epidural, I was myself again and talking. I'll deliver 3 babies with this shit, I boasted. Somebody do my hair. I don't want to be ugly when the baby comes. Shannon started heating up the flat iron. It took forever for me to be dilated enough to start pushing, and even then, I didn't think the baby was coming. It felt like nothing was happening. I regretted that I hadn't planned a C-section, the celebrity thing to do. And while someone's already down there, they get a quick nip and tuck. Hadn't thought this out in a celebrity way. Then all of a sudden, the epidural went away. It was like it erased any memory of itself, and I experienced a kind of pain that if there had been a large rock around, I would have bludgeoned myself with it. That's how bad it was. Nobody tells you this shit. When they say it's like a period, they're lying. Having a head and full body emerge from your vagina is nothing like getting a period. Ma, I screamed, help me, help me. Late, there's nothing I could do, she shrugged helplessly. Oh, and did I mention that this entire thing was being taped for a VH1 special about my pregnancy and childbirth? Yep, of course. They edited out this whole part where I was cursing. In the final show, I looked so serene the whole time, but in truth, it was as far from a silent birth as you can get. Reach down now, my doctor said. As soon as I can touch her, I turned primal and started to pull her out. Give her to me, give her to me, give her to me. I had had visions of this moment long beforehand and made it clear, in no uncertain terms, that when I had my baby, I wanted her cleaned up before she was handed to me, preferably with Johnson & Johnson's baby shampoo, because I like the smell, and then wrapped in a nice white blanket. You know, like what you might find in a 40s movie with me in a white head wrap and great eyebrows. Instead, when she actually arrived, I was sweating and fat. I reached down to grab her and pulled her right up to my chest, and I couldn't stop kissing her. I was crying. Angela was crying. My mom, Nicole, and Shannon, everyone. She's beautiful, my mom said. On June 16th, the day after my 34th birthday, my daughter Sophia Bella was born. A couple of days later, when the nurse told me I was ready to go home, I looked at her like she had 3 heads. I can't stay here a week? No. So when Courtney Cox had her baby here just a week ago, you kicked her out? I bet not, because she was on Friends. She left in the same amount of time as you. And I bet she had a better room. Better show, better room. Nope. Same room. Really? Okay, but I'm not ready to leave. You're just going to trust us with this baby? Isn't there any psychological test I'm supposed to take? You'll be fine. If she has a fever of 104, come back. Well, why would she have a fever? What are you talking about? What if she has a 100-degree fever? The hospital staff practically had to push me out the door. And the minute I stepped outside, everything felt like a threat. We were in the middle of Beverly Hills, which was filled with exhaust. My baby's lungs are going to get ruined, I yelled. Driving home, I was sure that everybody on the road was trying to kill my baby. They knew I had a newborn, and they were responding by saying, let's get into an accident. She wasn't on Friends. Fuck her baby. In the hospital, Sophia was the perfect baby. Lying there in her little plastic bin, sleeping her ass off, no matter how loud people were talking. What I didn't realize was that she was resting up for home life, when suddenly she became allergic to sleeping. Every night, as soon as the sun went down, Sophia started crying. I started to develop a phobia of the dark. I don't want night to come, I said to Angela, I'm scared. It almost felt like vindictive on Sophia's part, like as soon as she knew there was no one to relieve us, that's when she started up. At 5 o'clock, our house became a ghost town because visitors don't come to see your newborn at that hour. I was begging the sun, no, 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 don't fall, don't go, son. And then, when friends asked what time would be a good time to come over and meet the baby, I answered, 5 o'clock. We're seeing people at 5 o'clock, at 10 p.m. and midnight. Angelo and I began reconnecting with folks we hadn't talked to since the second grade. Hey, what you doing? You want to come over and visit? We just had a baby. Come at 2 a.m. You can hold her for 5 hours if you like. We tried everything to get her to stop crying and sleep. Gas was the big theory, so I did that thing where you push the legs into the baby to let the gas out. Not only did it not work, but I worried I was breaking her little legs. Then I discovered that her diaper was cutting into her thighs and leaving little red marks. Maybe that's what she was crying about. I yelled at Angelo that he had to make sure to leave a finger of room in her diaper when he closed it up. As I laid her down on her changing table to diaper her, she started crying again. She doesn't like to be on her back. Maybe she has a thing with falling, I said while putting a pillow to prop her head up. She doesn't not like anything, Leah, Angelo said. Of course she does not like something, Angelo. She's crying. I have three kids that she didn't raise. Low blow, but all is fair when you're sleep deprived. Angelo and I had the nastiest deaf fights, where instead of speaking, we mouthed the words, fuck you, or I want a divorce, because we didn't want the baby to be any more upset than she already was. Things were so insane that I called a doctor and said, there's something seriously wrong with my baby. You need to come right away. I can't put her in the car. Things are very bad. Come quick. He dutifully came over right away and examined her. She doesn't sleep. She's crying all the time. All she's doing is eating and peeing and crapping and crying. That's what newborns do. So you're saying nothing's wrong with her. I want to be clear about this conversation for the lawsuit. You're saying there's nothing wrong with her. There's nothing wrong with her. Welcome to parenthood. So you're telling me that normal babies never sleep and always cry. As I said, welcome to parenthood. Are you even a real doctor? And with that, he closed the door behind him, leaving Angela and me standing in the entryway of her house with our crying baby. Sophia continued to cry her head off for the next few months. Everyone thought they could cure her. Everyone, including every Scientologist I knew, offered advice. As new parents, we felt as if we were doing everything wrong. They told us that it must be something about her environment or that technology wasn't being applied correctly. Friends would take the baby and do a Scientology assist, a hands-on form of auditing that you can do anywhere without any equipment. They would take her outside and have her touch a tree, a leaf, the grass. All she would do was continue to cry and scream. So when I woke up one morning and didn't see Angelo and the baby in my bedroom, I ran downstairs in a panic. I almost ran past him in the den where he was, gasped, sitting on the couch drinking coffee. What's happening? I panted, looking over to see Sophia drooling in front of the TV. What is that? What are those ugly things? Why are they making that sound? Why is she being quiet? Shh, Angelo said. They're Teletubbies, and they are magic. I looked at our daughter, who was mesmerized, as if the show had suspended her brain. It was genius. She was like a vegetable. Could we just sit here and have a cup of coffee? Could this be real? How much time do you think we have? I asked. Don't ruin it, Angelo said. Just enjoy. Chapter 11. When Sophia was first born, I had a support system that most women can only dream of, and yet there were still times when I would run to the grocery store for no reason at all, just to get out of the house. I would walk up and down every aisle, even aisles that no one goes down, like the one with the auto supplies, feeling like the worst mom ever. There I was, hiding out in Albertsons because I needed to be away from the bottles, the diapers, the crying. Just for a moment, I wanted to feel like my old self again. In addition to figuring out how to be a mom, I had to also continue to be the breadwinner for my family, which meant losing all the weight I had gained during my pregnancy. I had only 4 weeks after Sophia's birth to return to the King of Queens set, and the pounds were not coming off quickly. I'd never really had body issues, even though I was in an industry where women are constantly scrutinized for their weight. But after Sophia was born, I got a complex. I kept thinking of all those actresses who seemed to be back to their old selves by the time they left the hospital with their newborns. I worked out 3 or 4 times a week, did the fat flush, tried the cayenne drink cleanse, suffered through the cabbage soup diet. Some people in the business suggested diet pills, but because I was a Scientologist, that was off limits. So I returned to work, still 40 pounds overweight. Everyone on the King of Queens was encouraging after I had Sophia. The producers accommodated me in any way possible so that I could bring her with me to the set. Still, I needed a full-time nanny. Even though I interviewed a bunch of candidates, Trish stood out immediately. Taking Sophia from my arm, she said, "Bless," in her English accent, and then started noticing things that I adored too, like the rolls on my daughter's legs. I was so impressed by how loving Trish was because for me, That was what it was all about. I just wanted to know that when I couldn't be with Sophia, somebody who loved her was with her. The clincher, however, came when Trish put my daughter on her big, huge bajunga tits and Sophia fell right to sleep. "Those are magical tits, which I'm sure your husband has told you," I said as the deal was sealed. Trish was a traditional nanny and not a Scientologist, and I preferred it that way, even though all of my friends urged me to use a Scientologist nanny. I didn't use Scientology tools in dealing with my daughter because I didn't want her to be ridiculed for anything that seemed strange to the general public. For example, I was told that if she got hurt, I was not to react, but perform a contact assist, which consists of putting an injured body part exactly on and in the place it was injured. So, if she hit her leg on the corner of the coffee table, I was supposed to remain quiet and gently touch the hurt part of her leg to the exact spot on the table where she hit it, and continue to repeat that action until she said it was better. Instead, the second I heard Sophia crying from a fall or bang, I was shouting, "Are you okay? Mommy will kiss it, make it better." I refused to raise Sophia in a way that would make her incompatible with the rest of the world, as I felt I was, and as were many second-generation Scientologists. Even though Sophia is now 11, I still have Trish. What can you do? I'm a family person. Whether it be the cast and crew of a television show, a friend, or a nanny, I quickly grow attached. It's hard for me to let go of people. Going to the playground with Trish and Sophia when she was a toddler was certainly an education. After we had been watching Sophia sit in that disgusting sandbox for a while, I asked Trish, "How much longer were we going to stay?" "Love, we've only been here 2 minutes," she said. "I'm just asking because in the baby world, time is totally irrelevant. Like, if we started to randomly pack up, I mean, she wouldn't know if we'd been here for an hour or 5 minutes." "Darling, parents usually stay until the kids' nap time." "That's 2 hours from now. Is an ice cream truck going to come by? Is anything going to happen? Is there a crime in progress we can stop? I mean, this is just not enough. Let's take her on the swings." God. Most moms used to look at me with a confused expression and say, "You don't love playing with your daughter?" Then I would start lying about it. "Oh, of course I love it. I mean, God, every moment's a joy. I just cherish the time, which is going by so fast that I'm thinking about having another one." "Out of your own vagina? Why would someone do that to themselves?" I thought there was something wrong with me because I never understood the joy in playing with my kid. When Sophia got older and she insisted we play Barbies while she was in the tub, I usually lasted about 4 minutes before I tried to weasel out of the game. "My Barbie is tired," I would say. "My Barbie wants to go to sleepy." "No, she doesn't want to go to sleepy. She just got up," Sophia would insist. "No, she needs to go sleepy. Because she stayed up all night. She stayed up all night because she wanted her babas, and she's too tired right now, so mine's going to go to bed." I really admired other parents I saw running around with their kids. I thought, how nice is that for their children? But they also left me racked with guilt. Until one mother, out of the dozens I met, told me I shouldn't feel bad. "You're not your daughter's playmate," she said, and I nearly burst out in tears because I needed to hear that so badly. I loved my child and liked to watch her be happy. While I wasn't so much a player, I did love spending time with her. I also loved taking care of her, protecting her, and setting up her future, but playing, eh. And while I may not have been the best mother in the world, I was the one paying the bills, providing for my family, and trying to clear the planet. Between Sophia, work, and the church, I had a tall order to fill. When I returned to the King of Queens, the time spent at the studio and the hours spent every day at the church left me lucky to have any time at all with my daughter. And I felt the weight of it, often thinking that I wasn't giving adequate attention to one or another part of my life. Now that I was on my OT levels and diligently participating in auditing and my studies, my commitment to Scientology was more consuming than ever. I was typically at the church all day if I wasn't at work. On top of that, I was a celebrity, which meant I had more responsibility than ever to be a positive and active member of my church. My special celebrity status that came around the time I was on Fired Up also had its benefits. When I went back to FLAG to work on my OT levels 20 years after leaving the Sea Org, I fully expected other Sea Org members to look down on me, because it's pretty much policy to view ex-Sea Org members as deserters. But because I was on TV and had appeared on the cover of Scientology Celebrity Magazine, I was treated within the church like, well, like a star. It was so strange to be staying at the Fort Harrison like any other parishioner. Occasionally, I would have flashbacks to that nightmare period of my life, when as a teenager I was ripped from everything I knew in Brooklyn, only to end up cleaning hotel rooms at FLAG. After I returned, every time I ate dinner in one of the hotel restaurants, I remembered how I used to steal food because I was so hungry. During one of my sessions at FLAG, I gave this up as a transgression, and my auditor asked how much I thought I owed to make up the damage for the food I stole 20 years earlier. "I don't know," I said. "How much was custard and hamburgers for 3 months in the 80s? "Well, let's just round it up to $40,000, okay?" $40,000? I was dumbfounded. But I was also trying to get onto my OT level, so I paid the church $40,000 for this transgression. The real surprise of the trip, though, wasn't my huge bill for the snacks I stole back then. It was seeing Mike Curley, the head of the EPF when I was in Clearwater, and the guy who threw me overboard into the ocean. I spotted him while I was walking out to the Fort Harrison's pool. He was still doing the same job, leading a group of shell-shocked young Sea Org members. I stopped him and asked, "Do you remember me, Mike?" "Yeah," he said, "you're the little bullbuster Leah. You're a big celebrity now. I saw you on all our magazines. You do so many great things for the church. I'd always knew you'd make it. I always knew you had something. Even when you threw me off that fucking boat?" He laughed and said, "You were okay." I had imagined this moment more than a few times in my mind, that I would confront him for the way he treated me. Instead, he met me with admiration. "You know, I'm actually kind of glad it didn't work out in the Sea Org," he said, justifying his reason for being so happy to see me. "Because you do so much more for our church being a star." And with that, all of my resentment washed away in an instant. All Scientologists are expected to present an image to the outside world that is so perfect and happy that people can't help but want to join. If you are a celebrity, your reach is that much greater. And celebrities are expected to use the full extent of their power to bring new parishioners into the fold. However, I wasn't really comfortable with recruiting new members. Instead of getting new people into Scientology, my instinct was to do the opposite, because I knew what an extremist religion it was, all in or all out. I knew how onerous the commitment to this religion was, and how, despite what certain church representatives said, you had to leave any other belief behind, and I didn't want to be responsible for others making such a big decision. What I decided to focus on instead was assisting other participating Scientologists. So I started doing events to help people move up the bridge faster, which I enjoyed. I gave speeches and seminars for those stalled on the bridge, meaning people who, after becoming clear, achieving a state of total clarity and control over your thoughts and emotions, stay there and don't move on to their OT levels, like I did. I pushed by reminding them, if you signed up for this, then you need to get on with it. So while I wasn't overly keen on being a missionary and dodged constant pressure from the church to bring new members in, I found that I couldn't keep my mouth shut when I saw injustice or someone having trouble speaking for himself or herself. Being so confrontational made me an unofficial advocate for Scientologists who were having problems within the church, because I would say anything to anyone, no matter how high their supposed rank. One of those people was Stacey Francis. I had met Stacey through a friend and had instantly fallen in love with her. She was very funny, very New York, and very loud, just like me. But more than anything, I had felt drawn to Stacey because she reminded me of me where I used to be, struggling and without family support. So I welcomed her into ours, becoming not just a friend, but a kind of mother as well. I counseled Stacey through her first marriage, her pregnancy, her divorce. I was her daughter's godmother, and when they had nowhere to go for a month, I took them in. One day when we were sitting outside, she gestured to the house and pool and asked, "How do I get all this?" "Hard work," I answered. "It doesn't happen overnight. Now, come on. It's got to be that Scientology stuff that you're involved in. It must have given you a leg up in the business." Stacy touched on a myth that the church has very successfully used to its advantage. Many people were under the same impression that there are tons of Scientologists in the film and television business, and that we all help each other out. The truth is that while the church would like you to believe it wields a tremendous amount of influence in Hollywood, that is simply not the case. Throughout my career, I knew of one minor casting director who was a Scientologist, but other than that, no real movers and shakers. As a matter of fact, I think identifying myself publicly as a Scientologist probably hurt my career more than it helped it as far as perception was concerned. And while some of the courses the church offered provided me with better communication skills to help land roles, the time, the money, and the effort I invested certainly didn't outweigh the benefit for me. "You gotta bring me in," Stacy continued, almost insisting. I explained the basic tenets and courses, and she said, "I want that Tom Cruise shit." Having grown up a preacher's daughter, she was questioning her faith, especially how it was not necessarily helping her to obtain her goal of being a professional singer. I reluctantly brought her into the church, introducing her to some of the initial coursework. I felt responsible for her well-being. I told her not to give out her address or phone numbers. The church is notorious for putting you on a mailing list for the rest of your life, and piles of mail come to your house indefinitely. I had heard over and over again about people who signed up for one single course and nothing more, but had to shut down their mailbox because they were inundated with so much mail and propaganda. If you failed to show up for course and they had your phone number, they would call and harass you. I didn't want Stacy to have to go through that experience if she chose not to move forward with Scientology. Stacy ended up joining the church, and from what I witnessed throughout our time together, she was looking for validation and not getting it. While she was a big mouth and a troublemaker, which I loved, she didn't have the celebrity status yet and all that went with it. One time, Stacy brought her friend Brandy Norwood, the singer, to the church in hopes of recruiting her. After a few months, Brandy started to pull away, and in an attempt to keep her engaged, she was asked by a church official, while she was standing next to Stacy, if she'd like to go to a barbecue at Tom Cruise's house. Stacy immediately chimed in with, "Where's my invite? What the fuck do I look like?" She got sent for a sec check for that one. A sec check, short for security check, is a hardcore form of interrogation using the e-meter in which an auditor asks a long list of questions to make sure a person hasn't engaged in any hostile activities or thoughts towards the church. While I would often stick up for Stacy and others throughout my Scientology career, there were some people I would not stick my neck out for. One Sunday in early 2005, Sherry and I had finished playing tennis, like we did almost every week. And we got in our cars to head for breakfast per our usual routine. Except on this Sunday, Sherry phoned me from the car to say her brother was going to meet us at the restaurant. Although Sherry had left the church decades ago, we had an understanding that we'd leave Scientology out of our relationship. It was the only way I could justify maintaining our friendship, but now by ambushing me with her brother, she had broken our code. In the fall of 2004, Sherry's brother Stefan had left the church very publicly in a rift over his wife. Stefan and Tanya, who met in the Sea Org, had both been uplines, meaning they were high-ranking executives working for the church's top leader, chairman of the board, or COB, David Miscavige. In 1999, however, as punishment for financial and ethical transgressions against the church, Stefan was sent to the Rehabilitation Project Force, or RPF, at Gold Base, the sprawling and remote 500-acre compound near Hemet, California, also known as International Base. Stefan contended that it was because he had gotten on David Miscavige's bad side that he had been assigned to the reconditioning program for Sea Org members, the RPF. As mentioned earlier, these are the people who wear black, are required to run everywhere, are not allowed to speak unless spoken to, and perform the most demeaning and arduous manual labor with no days off. I had met David Miscavige a number of times at various events, after which a few of us would go meet in the president's office, the special area of the Celebrity Center reserved for celebrities and VIPs. David, short, trim, and well-built with blue eyes and light brown hair, had always treated me with respect, and I liked his wife Shelley a lot. She was tough and something of a rule-breaker like me, but I also found her kind. COB's wife, also referred to as COB's assistant, for nearly two decades, Shelley could always be found at his side at any public meetings or events. She was also CC'd on all of his correspondence. She was devoted to COB, as she had been to L. Ron Hubbard, to whom she reported as one of his original messengers, and assisted him in many capacities. I first met Shelley when we both attended a Tom Cruise movie premiere. She invited me to sit with her, and we quickly hit it off, afterward regularly exchanging cards and gifts at holidays. I remember she was so grateful when I had my makeup person get her ready for a CC Celebrity Center gala. Meanwhile, she stuck her neck out for me when I brought a friend who was not a Scientologist to the Celebrity Center to try and get some help with some issues he was going through. This was probably one of five friends I had ever brought into the church in my 30-plus years with Scientology. My friend was struggling in his marriage, and I thought that perhaps he might benefit from some of the courses or auditing that the church offered. I was not trying to recruit him into the church. I was just trying to have him apply some of the technology I had learned in hopes of helping him in his marriage. I handpicked who I requested to be in charge of his service, but I was met with resistance and told that I didn't have the right to decide who would work with him. I immediately went to Shelley, and she made sure that not only did I get the supervisor I wanted, but no one pushed me out of being involved. I also didn't want anyone I brought in to be dragged into regular church procedure. I wanted to protect them from that. The David Miscavige that my friend Sherry described that morning was very different from the affable COB David that I knew. According to Sherry, he threw Stefan into the RPF after Stefan objected to the amount of time COB demanded from Tanya, who was one of his secretaries. Stefan remained in the RPF for almost 4 years, during which time Tanya was encouraged to end their marriage. While they were apart, the couple ignored orders and remained in contact by cell phone. When David found out that his orders had been disobeyed, Tanya was removed from her position and demoted to a much lesser position. And that's when Stefan blew, a term reserved for Scientologists who leave without approval and without letting anyone know. In theory, it is possible to leave the church on good terms, but it involves a lengthy process that involves endless sec checks and usually winds up with the Scientologist deciding to stay rather than pay a costly freeloader's debt. Stefan had escaped, and for that, he was labeled an SP. "Sherry, come on," I said to her in my car. "You know I can't talk to him." She wanted me to talk to her brother, who had now been officially declared a suppressive person. The church forcibly stated that all parishioners had to disconnect from any SPs and cut off all contact with them. "Just listen to what he has to say. This is uncomfortable. Actually, it's worse than that. You're putting me in a position that will have consequences. Please, for me." Ugh, I was deeply conflicted. Despite our ups and downs, Sherry was one of my oldest and closest friends. We had known each other and helped each other when we had nothing but each other. Still, Scientology was now the framework for my entire life, and what she was asking me to do could get me in serious trouble and my family as well, so I split the difference. On the way to the restaurant, I called my MAA, Julian Schwartz, to ask him what he knew about Stefan. "Why?" "It's my friend Sherry's brother, and we're meeting for breakfast." I knew the minute I said this, Sherry was going to come up in every sec check for every OT level I'd get for the rest of my life. "Don't go," he said. "I have to. Leah, I'm asking you not to go." "I'm going, Julian." "Well, then we're going to have to talk." "Okay, then we're going to be talking." I was so angry by the time I sat down at the table with Sherry and Stefan that I could hardly look at the legal documents he wanted to show me. He wanted to get Tanya out of international base. But when he left Scientology, the church offered him $25,000 in return for a contract that would keep him from ever contacting another Scientologist again, including his wife. He signed the contract so he could make copies and show an attorney, and soon after that gave the check back and voided the contract. "I'm not taking the money because I'm going to get my wife out," he said to me. "But I don't know why you felt the need to come to me," I said. I didn't like Stefan when he was still in the church. I thought he was a terrible brother to Sherry and put her through the ringer when she left Scientology, so I certainly wasn't going to help him now. Stefan, look. What do you want me to do? Pick up the phone and call David Miscavige? Honestly, it just shows how stupid you actually are. I don't have any power to break a girl out. All that's going to come from this stupid presentation is that I'm going to be thrown into a sec check. Why don't you just read the document, Sherry said. For what? You're not hearing me. There's nothing I can do. And Sherry, now I'm going to have to deal with why we've been friends all these years and why I was lying about you not being against Scientology. So thank you for ending our friendship over this asshole. And with that, I got up and left. On the drive home, I called Julian, just as he had asked me to do, and told him everything that happened, which was nothing. When I got home, however, there waiting for me was a representative of the Office of Special Affairs, the legal branch of the church. For an hour or so, the OSA person grilled me on exactly what had been said and by whom, all the while taking notes that he slipped into a black briefcase before leaving. When I closed the door behind him, I was devastated because, as per the church, that would be the end of my friendship with Sherry. I felt I had no choice. Chapter 12. As a celebrity Scientologist, you are expected to be an example not only to the outside world, but also to other Scientologists. Moving up the bridge is important in setting an example for the group. And so is donating money. A lot of money. I donated millions of dollars over my life to my church to help set an example. The church is relentless when it comes to fundraising and soliciting. The plea is always a variation on the same refrain. You're a celebrity. You gotta step up, because if you do it, people who are not contributing will start to, so you need to do this to save the planet. I felt a combination of coercion and responsibility. When I heard from the church the causes my money was being put toward, I believed them. They range from protecting religious freedom to helping workers who were at Ground Zero after 9/11 through the New York Rescue Workers Detoxification Project. In 2002, the New York Detox, as it's known, began offering free treatments to firefighters, first responders, and police officers. Based on L. Ron Hubbard's writings, the detoxification regimen flushed poisons out of the body by employing an intense combination of multiple hours in and out of the sauna, high doses of niacin, jogging, and other elements. I donated over $100,000 to sponsor these first responders and fundraised on the cause's behalf for additional donations. As my donations grew, however, so did my questions about where my money was actually going. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina in August 2005, I gave $50,000 for a special mission of Scientology volunteer ministers to take food, water, and supplies to the hurricane victims in New Orleans, an effort spearheaded by Kirstie Alley. When I asked to see some kind of evidence that actual supplies were being handed out, however, I was given the runaround. Even though I knew church officials thought I was a pain in the ass because I complained all the time, I said, give me a picture of somebody from Scientology volunteer ministers handing out a fucking bottle of water in New Orleans, not a booklet, about our beliefs. Why are you always questioning your church's intention? Asked my handler, Shane Woodruff. Shane had become my unofficial liaison with the church once I reached celebrity status. Because I see volunteer ministers with their yellow shirts on handing out Way to Happiness booklets, as opposed to the water that you told me you were going to give them, I said to Shane. I wondered if we were helping anyone other than fellow Scientologists, or just giving off an appearance of this for all the world to see. Were we actually helping the world at large in the way I had been told? Those questions gnawed at me all the time, but particularly when I agreed to help open the Inglewood Org in the neighborhood southwest of downtown L.A., I agreed to donate $100,000 to get the basic books needed for the org to be considered a church. But I had my own set of stipulations that I made very clear. In a meeting I held with all the organizers, I said they had to reach out to the community to find out what they needed in their neighborhood. I also demanded that we create a children's center because mothers can't go on course for 2.5 hours a day and stick their kids in some bullshit nursery. Let's open up a center that's wonderful for the kids, so Mom could feel like she did something great for her child, I said. You want my help? That's what I'm willing to put my name on. At a follow-up meeting to discuss the Inglewood Org's opening, slated for Thanksgiving, the team presented me with its plan to meet the community's needs. "We came up with this," one self-satisfied Scientologist told me. "We're handing out turkeys with a Way to Happiness book." First of all, the idea that you think anyone needs your fucking turkey is condescending. But on top of that, you have the balls to stuff it with the Way to Happiness? The entire room went quiet. I knew they were shocked not only by how I was talking to them, but also because I thought their idea was terrible. In turn, I was angry not only because their idea was shitty, but also because they didn't know it was a shitty idea. As I felt many times before, I wish these Scientologists had better human technology. "I'm out," I said. In the aftermath of that meeting, the group working on the new org begged me to go to the opening. David Miscavige personally requested that I be there, and they would be held to pay for everyone if I didn't show up. But they wouldn't back down on their turkey and booklet plan, so I compromised. I agreed to go to the opening, but said I would only sit there. I'm not speaking because I don't want to be part of this org. They picked me up at my house, probably just to make sure I actually went. There was always something the church needed money for. Nearly every single day when I came out of session at the Celebrity Center, there was a member of the International Association of Scientologists, IAS, waiting for me in the parking lot. According to the official literature, the purpose of the group, formed in 1984, is to unite, advance, support, and protect the Scientology religion and Scientologists in all parts of the world so as to achieve the aims of Scientology as originated by L. Ron Hubbard. But the IAS is also the powerful fundraising arm of the church. The IAS rep waiting for me in the parking lot would say, "Can we talk for a second?" And my heart would sink. Did I care about mankind? Did I care about the state of the planet? Did I care about other Scientologists who were being persecuted as we spoke? It was just money. And as LRH says, you could always make more money. And as I said, it was relentless. I had given here and there to specific projects, but it was when the IAS came into my own house to make the case for why I needed to give even more that I made my first major donation. I'll never forget how the IAS representative banged on my kitchen table saying, "Do you see this?" She had brought some anti-Semitic propaganda used in Nazi Germany that depicted Jews with large hooked noses and a caption that read, "The Jew is identified by their greedy long noses." According to the IAS rep, they were using the very same propaganda against Scientologists. "Do you see this? This is what's going on in Germany right now. They're making Scientologists wear armbands. You're Jewish. How can you let this happen?" I couldn't let it happen, or any other crisis the IAS brought to my attention, so I kept giving and giving and giving. It was after I made a single donation of $1 million to the IAS that I first saw Tom Cruise in the president's office. The mere fact that I was fit to be in Tom's presence was a huge compliment. The actor wasn't just an A-list movie star, but a pillar of the church. Because of his good work on behalf of Scientology, he was called Mr. Cruise, which was a big deal, since in the church, the honor of Mr. was reserved only for the highest executives, including women in the Sea Org. Usually when Tom Cruise came into Celebrity Center, CC for short, the building was locked down, and the other celebrities he used the president's office had to come and go by the other entrance. When this happened, I would sit in the courtyard or the waiting room. But on this particular day, my handler, Shane, met me at my car before I entered the office to say, "I just want you to know that Mr. Cruise is here, but it's fine for you to walk through." I had met Tom before at public events, but here I wasn't quite sure how to proceed. I asked if I should pretend I didn't see him. I honestly didn't know how to act. Tom, who was already in the room, was on the phone. He gestured for me to sit down. When he trained his gaze on me, I felt very important. He was the perfect example of what Scientologists call NPR in the world. Someone who's highly regarded and brings goodwill and respect to themselves and to Scientology. We had a brief but pleasant conversation. He had that magical quality that makes the person he's talking to, in this case me, feel like the only one in the world. You feel that he's super interested in what you have to say. He brings an intensity to the interaction. That's very Tom. I figured that all I was doing for my church by way of time and money had resulted in Tom's approval. We were on the same team. Tom and me. Super twin powers activate. I was never more ready to do this clear the planet thing. Not long after that day when I first met Tom in the president's office, I began to be invited to events and get-togethers involving Tom by his church liaison, Tommy Davis, who wasn't just any Sea Org member, but from a prominent family within the church. His mother was a Scientologist and actress, Ann Archer. With his pedigree and good looks, it's no wonder that he was Tom's liaison with the church, and later became a spokesperson for the church. Because of my record, I was approved for Tom's entourage, a small group of heavily contributing with the program Scientologists that included Earthlink founder Sky Dayton, Marisol Nichols, Ethan Suplee, and Jenna and Bodie Elfman. Noticeably absent from the chosen few were Kirstie Alley and John Travolta. I had heard that Tom didn't like them. The honor came with its own set of obligations. You just didn't say no to Mr. Cruz, even when it came to little things. Like when he invited me and Angelo over when I was pregnant with Sophia because he wanted to learn to dance salsa. Angelo had offered to teach him, but when we were called to come over, it was a last-minute invitation, so I tried to get out of it or reschedule, but Tommy Davis, who had made the call, said to us, "Make it go right." We drove onto the massive gated rental estate, which included formal gardens, a sunken tennis court, and a main house. As soon as we walked into the house, we were met by a Sea Org member who said that Tom had only an hour because he had to listen to his congresses, a newly issued set of tapes that we were all mandated to buy and listen to. "I wasn't the one who called us to come over and do Tom a favor, Tommy," I replied as we walked into the living room. I was surprised by what I saw. In addition to Tommy Davis, there was Jessica Feshback, another Sea Org member from an extremely powerful Scientology family. In the 80s, her father Joe Feshback built a billion-dollar hedge fund business with his brothers by aggressively shorting stocks. The Feshback brothers credited their success to LRH Tech and ran their firm with strict adherence to Scientology's principles. But the most unexpected guest in the living room that night was the actress Katie Holmes. I didn't know Katie and Tom were dating, but I quickly got the picture since he couldn't keep his hands off her. What I didn't understand was Tommy and Jessica's presence. Did they want to learn salsa too? I felt uncomfortable as Angelo and I started to go through a few moves with Tom, as if these high-ranking Sea Org members were sitting there to supervise. They certainly weren't reining Tom in as he was manhandling Katie, dipping her in a forceful way and then making out with her. "You guys might want to get a room because we haven't even started yet," I joked. In response, I received a sharp look from Tommy and Jessica. From that point on, we were invited to Tom's compound for dinner regularly. And almost every time we went over there, Tommy and Jessica were also in the mix. In my view, it crossed a line for any Sea Org member to be at Tom's house, since my and most Scientologists' understanding was that Sea Org members are here to clear the planet and deliver services. They aren't supposed to fraternize socially with the public or parishioners. If this had been a church event, and they were there in service to Tom and Katie, or protecting them as their church liaisons, that would have been completely different. But this was just dinner with another Scientology couple at home. When I got Jessica alone, I asked her what she was doing there. "I'm on post," she said. "Well, we're having dinner. What job are you doing? I don't get your purpose here." "I work for CC," she said, which was hard for me to believe, given that I was at Celebrity Center almost every day and had hardly ever seen her there. It also didn't answer my question. I knew she and Tommy worked for COB. Tommy's and Jessica's off-putting presence added to the weird feeling we got at Tom's house. It was hard to place, but there was an energy in the air, like we were being watched. It was as if, at any moment, you could be ejected from his Beverly Hills mansion and sent to Flag in Florida to scrub toilets. As the dinners continued and we spent more time with Tom, I came to think of him as a big kid with his loud laugh, high energy, and goofy ideas of fun. Like when he invited some Scientologists and a few other celebrities like Will Smith's wife Jada Pinkett Smith to his house and announced he wanted to play hide-and-seek. At first, I thought he was joking, but no, he literally wanted to play hide-and-seek with a bunch of grown-ups in what was probably close to a 7,000-square-foot house on almost 3 full acres of secluded land. Yeah, I can't play. I'm wearing Jimmy Choo's," I said. "Well, good," Tom said with his signature grin. "So you're it, then." And with that, he tagged me and ran to hide. "Huh?" I pulled my husband aside and in a quiet voice whispered, Angelo, you're going to go ahead and do this because I'm not doing it. I'm not trying to play a fucking game of hide and seek in 5-inch stilettos, okay? People were terrified of offending Tom, and not without reason. Once when Angela and I were over, Tom decided he wanted to make cookies. He walked into the kitchen where a batch of prepackaged cookie dough had been prepared and was sitting on the counter, a perfect loaf ready for cutting and baking. Tom was looking for flour and other ingredients and must not have seen the cookie dough, and he instantly got angry. Guys, where's the cookie stuff? He said, furrowing his brow. His assistants came running in, wanting to explain that it was right there on a nearby counter, but all one of them could say was, Tom? They both grew more flustered, and Tom got angry. God damn it! Looking at the dough sitting on a cutting board, obvious to all of us except Tom, I wished his assistant would say, hey, the stuff is right there under your nose, dumbass, but she didn't. She couldn't. Instead, Katie whispered something to Tom, who repeated, can I just get the stuff of the cookies, guys? Although his voice was lower, there was still a seething quality to his request that made his assistant even more flustered. Tom seemed like a child who had never been told no. People say that celebrities stop developing emotionally at the age of their success, which for Tom had been with risky business at 21. Get in the fucking present time is what you need to do, he then screamed at his assistant. As he lit into her, I thought about the time a friend had mentioned to me that she witnessed him taking his assistant to task for giving him a chipped coffee mug. You serve me tea in a chipped mug? Do you know who gets served with a mug that's chipped? Fucking DBs, he said, using the initials for degraded being, a term in Scientology that means degraded spiritual being. Still not noticing the log of pre-made dough on the counter, Tom raised his hand above his head. Ella Rach is here, he said, then lowered his hand to his chin and said, and Dave and I are here. Then with his hand down at his waist, he said, and you are here. An uncomfortable heat rose in my body, just like it used to when I was a kid being yelled at by my dad. It was horrible to watch someone I admired come undone, and even worse, to witness the fear in the assistant's eyes. Tom comes across with an almost presidential charm to the public, but seeing him treat people this way was utterly shocking. I've seen celebrities, myself included, treat people or staff poorly, but this was on another level. The whole scene was so painful to watch that I had to step in. Oh, wait, I said, as if I had just discovered something. Tom, is this it? He looked at the dough. The assistant looked at him, and I was looking at the both of them, all of us incredulous. Oh, he said, thanks, and that was it. It was one thing to act like an overgrown child in his own home, but when Tom had his infamous Oprah incident, I picked up the phone and called Shane. I wanted to know what they were going to do about Tom, who proclaimed his love for Katie Holmes by jumping on the daytime host couch in a move that creeped out most of America. His behavior reflected badly on Scientology and me. Leah is just very uptone, Shane said. The Scientology term for high tone on the emotional tone scale. Tom and the church had become a laughingstock, and we were calling it uptone? The guy's really happy, and you should be happy for him. Again, I felt like maybe I'm just an asshole, and maybe there is something really and truly wrong with me. Is that just a foreign concept to me? Happiness? Real love? I wondered if Angelo would jump on a couch for me. Meanwhile, ever since my first time at Tom's house, I'd been questioning why there were Sea Org members constantly hovering around. Well, I had my own theory. It was to make sure nothing upset Tom, and if it did, to immediately report it to the church, specifically to COB David Miscavige. Once, when we were at the compound for dinner, Angela made a joke about some celebrity we were friends with. Jessica, who was acting as Katie's Scientology chaperone to keep the actress on track and doing Scientology, pulled me aside and asked me details about the joke. When I asked her why, she said, I'm just collecting the data. The next day, Jessica wrote a knowledge report stating that Mr. Cruz had observed Angelo joking about another celebrity and Leah did nothing about it. We were both pulled into session immediately. I was furious. Tom was a big boy. If he had a problem with me or my husband, he could just write it up himself, which was proper policy. And really, all for a joke about one of our friends? In the church, though, Tom's status only grew despite his public behavior. He followed his Oprah appearance with his even more infamous one on the Today Show, where, in an interview with Matt Lauer, he chastised Brooke Shields for taking psychopharmaceuticals to deal with postpartum depression. The church's response was to hold a huge event for him at the Shrine Auditorium to present how prescriptions for Ritalin and other psychotropic drugs were down something like 500%, thanks to Tom and his recent comments. According to the church, Tom had single-handedly taken down the psychiatric profession. As I watched Tom get a standing ovation from all the Scientologists who filled the massive auditorium, I started to question my judgment. Look at this guy, I thought. He's doing great things for the world, and you're criticizing his couch jumping? I felt more than downtone. Maybe I'm a degraded being and an SP. I certainly didn't think he and Katie deserved the scrutiny they underwent from the press after their daughter was born in the spring of 2006. Because the first pictures of Suri didn't appear until she was almost 5 months old, there was wild speculation about whether she existed and what this mystery baby was like. I experienced a small taste of the media frenzy around this infant when I attended my first Emmy Award show a little more than a week before the Annie Leibovitz portraits of baby Suri appeared in Vanity Fair. Tom's kid was the last thing on my mind that day. Kevin had been nominated for lead actor in a comedy series, which was exciting for everyone on The King of Queens, because in our 9 seasons on the air, no one had been nominated for a single Emmy. While walking the red carpet on a day that was so brutally hot I was sweating everywhere, I stopped to do an interview with Ryan Seacrest. "So, Leah, this is an exciting time," he said. "Yes, it is, Ryan. We heard you saw Suri." I didn't see that coming. "Yeah, you know what's also big news, too? Kevin was just nominated for an Emmy for the first time in the history of the show." He gave me a kind of look like I had an attitude, which of course I did, but this was only the start of it. Every single fucking interview on that broiling red carpet was about the baby. "You seen Suri? What's she look like?" "Well, you know what Tom and Katie look like? That's what the baby looks like." "Well, what's she like?" "Well, I don't know. What are babies like? Is she a real baby? Last I checked!" To add insult to injury after all that bullshit, Tony Shalhoub stole Kevin's Emmy. It was not my night, despite the fact that I had Kevin's Emmy speech written out for him, beginning with, "I want to thank Remini for..." Of course, I didn't bring any of that up the next time I saw Tom and Katie. At the end of the night, when they walked us out to our car, Tom said, "Hey, we have some news. You have to keep this hush-hush." It wasn't very hard to guess what the news was. "We're getting married," he said, "and we want you guys to come." I was excited for them, but I wanted to prove that I was Theta, not a DB or low-toned, that I could be really happy and up-toned, so I started jumping up and down. In the car later, Angela said the jumping up and down was a little much. Tom, who seemed pleased with my reaction, then asked if we wanted to invite our friends Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony to the wedding. "Don't you think you guys should?" I asked, confused. "Well, we don't really know them that well," Katie said. "Right," I thought, "exactly my point. And you want to invite them to your wedding?" Although I wondered why they wanted people they didn't know well enough to invite to their wedding, at their wedding, I agreed to ask Jennifer and Mark. This wasn't the first time I invited them to hang out with Tom and Katie. The couple had asked me to bring Mark and Jennifer over for dinner previously. Although I wasn't sure why, Katie wanted to meet Jen. I just assumed she was a fan of J-Lo. Angelo and I knew Mark way before he was with Jen. Our friendship started when the comedian Sinbad invited me to a Mark Anthony concert where I hung out afterward until 4 in the morning. Angelo, who didn't come with me, kept on texting me to come home. "It's not like that," I texted back. Angelo texted in return, "Get your ass home." I loved Mark like a brother and so was protective when he had Angelo and me meet his new girlfriend, Jennifer. "I want to punch you in your face," I said when I first met her, "because you're even prettier in person. I was kind of hoping you would be uglier." Jen, who has a good sense of humor about herself, laughed and we hit it off. We had a lot in common. She was from the Bronx, which, if we were back in New York, would be like a different country from Brooklyn, but in LA, it basically made us from the same neighborhood. And although Jen is Catholic, her father is a Scientologist, so she knew all about the church. I thought it would be fun to take a trip with her and Mark to Tom and Katie's wedding, so I called Jennifer the next day and said, "Hey, you want to go to Italy?" "For what? What are you talking about? Tom and Katie's wedding? I'm invited? Are there invitations coming? They're chartering a jet for everyone." "Let me ask Mark," she said, "but why not?" While I was happy to have my friend joining me at the wedding, I was uncomfortable with being asked to play the role of the intermediary, but I just felt like I couldn't say no to the request. Chapter 13. Tom and Katie's wedding was to take place in Rome in November of 2006. I was very excited and scared, as I had never been out of the country before, and this was going to be a star-studded affair covered by media outlets from all over the globe. The paparazzi would be mobbing us from the minute we stepped off the plane until we returned home. I needed a get-off-the-plane outfit, complete with sunglasses, a shopping-in-Rome outfit, and a sit-in-a-cafe-and-have-a-cappuccino outfit, not to mention the gowns and dresses for the rehearsal dinner and the wedding. I was going to need some professional help. Jennifer and I decided to hire a stylist to work with the both of us, which was great for me because the Jennifer Lopez's of the world get free shit from Gucci and YSL, whereas people like me get Sudafed. That's not true. I don't even get Sudafed. The stylist filled the empty room where Angelo and I were building a home library with racks and racks of clothes and used the shelves to display bags, hats, and shoes. It was the ultimate girl fun when Jen, the stylist, and I assembled outfits for every possible scenario in Italy. I mean, I'm half Italian, so they could be...